I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
My special guest today is a shining example of the transformative powers of learning. He battled all the odds. He was born blind, endured a childhood blighted by poverty, and was told his best chance in life was to become a piano tuner. Undeterred, he pursued education, an opportunity that proved an indelible influence to what came after. At 22, he was Britain's youngest councillor, and in 1997 became the first blind cabinet minister. As education secretary under Tony Blair, he fought tooth and nail to improve education for all, and he's not finished fighting just yet. Lord Blunkett, good afternoon. Absolutely delighted to have you on the programme.
David.
David, thank you, David. Very nice to have you here. I hope you're not sweltering in the same level.
I am, just like you.
You recently have penned what was, I think, meant to be a report, but turned out to be more of a manifesto. And in it, you described yourself as having the potential to be more of a resource to Keir Starmer. And he has just set about this very Blairite reshuffle. Are you hoping to be back in that cabinet, perhaps?
Cabinet? No. Those days have long gone. I'm not going to emulate Donald Trump and Joe Biden. I promise the listeners that I won't be doing that. No, I'm just happy to sit on the sidelines and be drawn down on and give advice when I'm asked. And that advice would be about what went wrong as well as what went right, and to throw out ideas that it's difficult for shadow cabinet members to do without upsetting the apple cart. So maybe I could throw one or two ideas out, not in the 3 months leading up to the election, but over the next month or two.
I mean, in fairness, it would appear there's just a sort of tsunami of woe around the education system and indeed infrastructure at the moment. We'll go on to talk about that in a second. But I mean, in terms of where we are now, how would you describe it succinctly in your beautiful way, of course?
My succinct would be a public relations disaster. I think there are real issues underlying all of this in terms of when investment was available, what was known, how things have been handled. But at the moment, the issue of this rack, this concrete, has sort of dominated the agenda for day after day, and frankly, diverts from a much more important issue, which is that children have just gone back or are just about to go back to school. Colleges are reopening, universities will be reassembling, and we really need to concentrate on what we're doing in the classrooms that still exist and the development of a very different kind of learning and teaching for the future. I've been arguing very strongly that artificial intelligence is both a challenge but an opportunity, and we need to teach about it and how people can use it so they don't get left behind, but we can also make it a resource for teaching in the classroom and at home. So there should be a revolution, in my view, in the way in which we approach the curriculum education for the future. And at the moment, we're arguing about concrete.
Indeed, and I want to unpick all of that with you in a moment, particularly the sort of combining of vocational and academic studies and so on. But, you know, earlier today, as you mentioned, there is a huge issue around not just concrete, perhaps, but also government ministers' behaviour. Earlier today on the breakfast programme, Nick Gibb, the schools minister, told Times Radio that Gillian Keegan's recent outburst were a result of frustration. Let's hear that.
but there's still 5% remaining. And we have chased those questionnaires several times.
So are they the people that are sitting on their arse? I just want to know who these people are.
Well, she's apologised for the use of that language. But what's the frustration is that we want those remaining 5% to respond. We've got a deadline now of this Friday by which they need to respond. And that was the kind of frustration. Okay.
You've done the job, David. Did you sympathise with Nick at all, or indeed with Gillian Keegan? You know, we've all said things when we didn't realise we were being overheard, I'm sure.
I personally like Gillian, and I think she's doing everything she can. I don't think that her remarks were aimed at people not getting surveys back. I think there's been lots of comments as to where they were aimed in terms of recent past decisions that were made. Mm. About not putting the investment in. And I would sympathise very greatly with her about that. I mean, I had some gigantic battles with Gordon Brown and the Treasury team over spending. But I was very fortunate because the moment we got in, even though we'd committed not to engage in substantial spending until the spending review took place 18 months later, we did have the windfall levy and we put immediately £1 billion into the pot for renewing and refurbishing schools, bearing in mind that we inherited a situation back in 97, without going over history, where we were spending less than £600 million a year on the whole of the school building programme, repairs as well as new build. So there had to be a transformation. By the time I left the job in 2001 and went to the Home Office, we were spending £4 billion a year, so you could see the transformation.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned 1997. Of course, as I understand it, this issue with RAC first came to light or first began to surface, dare I say, in around 1995. So it was a problem during New Labour's era as well. How aware of it were you back then?
I was aware of the issues around flat roofs, and actually it is associated with the flat roof problem, i.e., that you're going to get water penetration. And we had that in spades. We had buckets galore under roofs. We had windows falling out. We even had over 400 schools with only outside toilets. I mean, people listening, this is not the 19th century I'm talking about. This is 28 years ago. So it is a real 36 years ago. Gosh, I better do my maths properly. Go back to school, David. It is a real challenge going back a very long way. And I don't think people have fully realised until it looks like 2017. It's very hard to actually ascertain now just when the extent of the problem started to emerge. But the Comptroller and Auditor General, writing in the Times newspaper, of course, this morning, has highlighted that this is not something that has emerged over the school holidays.
And if you were still in the job and it was happening right now, I mean, gargantuan battles with Gordon Brown aside, or perhaps as part of it, what would you do? Because the situation is as it is, and there's a lot of furore. Obviously, in the media, it's a lot about who to blame. Ultimately, it feels like there's a long line of people to blame, or perhaps choices and decisions to blame.
What I would have done is to have phased this. Once you knew, well, at least 18 months ago, and survey work started, to try and phase it in terms of what the surveyors believed were the most dangerous. In other words, you have to make real choices in these decisions. I had to do that as Home Secretary in terms of resilience and what we had to do to protect ourselves. And sometimes that means you say, look, we'll tackle these first, because that's important. We'll give others notice that we are monitoring the situation regularly, and we'll plan for that work to be done over the next 2 years. Now, that might sound harsh, but I think it's a lot better than a panic where suddenly across the country, 150 schools find themselves substantially closed, and where we have to find alternative accommodation, and where we suddenly have to draw in very scarce resources in terms of construction in an unplanned way. So I know it's easy to be clever when you're not having to make the decisions and not being abused in Parliament for putting children at risk. But let me put it this way, Mariella. If I was Secretary of State for Education and Employment, which I was all those years ago, I would have said to Parliament, we have to tackle this in a thoughtful, planned, sensible way. Nobody wants to put children's lives at risk, but a panic doesn't actually help.
Mm. I mean, clearly the system lacks funding. Labour's main policy for achieving more funding for schools seems to be the abolishing of the charitable tax status for public schools. And I wonder if you think that's going to be enough, or if that doesn't just sustain this sort of sense of there being us and them, and perhaps isn't helpful in the much bigger picture of as you describe it, a revolution that needs to happen within the education system.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Well, that decision on priorities and resource would be what's called revenue, i.e. day-to-day spending, as opposed to raising the capital funding for school buildings, repair and maintenance, which we've just been talking about. Mm. So the question is, how do we get more money to actually transform both what's happening in the classroom, the shortage, the teacher shortage, which is substantial, and by the way, was the same back in the 90s. We had schools on four-day weeks in 96, 97. One of the reasons we got such a large majority, just one of the reasons, was that there were actually marches in market towns where people had never demonstrated in their lives because of what was happening to the schools. So we're almost deja vu, almost back where we started. It will be clear that in the first year or 18 months, an incoming government will not have vast sums of money. So we need to just get to grips with that. However, the notion that there is, quote, no money is a misunderstanding of how government works. We saw the Department for Education find the money for the teachers' pay award, the settlement that was reached in the summer. There are substantial underspends right across government at the moment. And not throwing it away, but a government coming in should ask every permanent secretary and bring in people from outside if need be to examine every possible area of the budget so that we could release resources to do what we want to do and to start building that for the future. To take net zero, we couldn't spend £28 billion, which is what we've committed to in the long term, in the first year anyway, because you have to plan to be able to put those measures in place. So you have to skill the people, you have to get the materials together, you have to have a plan. And so I think over the first 4 or 5 years of an incoming government, you will see substantial change, but it's all not going to happen in the first 12 months.
Mm. I mean, one of the things that Labour have said is unaffordable is the idea of free school meals. And you will be very aware of the degree of child poverty in the UK at the moment and the increase in visits to food banks and so on. Sadiq Khan was on the breakfast programme this morning talking about his London-wide free school meals. It seems to me, we're not in the 19th century, but it seems to me almost prehistoric that this sort of stigma of poverty continues to permeate our schools, with free school meals provision and the sense that children are, being identified for their family's lack of finance.
Well, we're back to prioritisation. I mean, in the ideal world of all worlds, we'd provide all children with a free breakfast when they arrived and free lunch and free milk, which is what I had when I went to school all those years ago. We can't. And there's an enormous deadweight cost here, which means that there's a lot of people who can afford perfectly well to provide a meal for their children, either in terms of them being able to go home or to have a decent meal at school. I think the big challenge is to expand the free school meals programme to make sure, and this happens in most schools now, that there isn't a stigma, that there is no lining up in one queue or having to present a docket so that it's clear that you're a free school meals recipient. That used to happen, but as far as I'm aware, in virtually all schools now, that's been eliminated, not least because you can do fingerprint recognition very easily. And secondly, that we should actually look at what happens in the holidays. Many local authorities have been providing substantial support over the summer. That happened during COVID. As you know, the government actually had a programme of the worst of the COVID period. We need to keep that going because children who are hungry are not hungry for 39 weeks of the year. They're hungry for 52 weeks.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's go to your weighty document on education, which, I mean, in truth, reads more like a sort of vision for the future of the country than simply a policy proposal. You've said that Labour needs to be radical. And you've used the word revolution already in our conversation. In what way?
Well, we're facing a massive change, which has already started, of course, in the world of work. People during the pandemic learned all kinds of ways of working, as you are today, Mariella, and that will accelerate. And the onset of artificial intelligence, the use of robotics, the way in which that changes, I don't just mean office jobs and those linked to digital. I'm talking about construction and healthcare and areas which link to net zero, all of which will be transformed by the technology of tomorrow. And we need to equip our young people either with vocational skills that might also overlap into academic, and academic skills that should overlap into vocational. After all, those taking on medical courses are both academic and vocational. Those doing engineering are academic and vocational. Even those doing theology, if they're going to being a vicar, is actually vocational. So we need to break down the barriers of vocational and academic, and each opportunity needs to be followed by the stepping stone of the next. So we're talking about lifelong learning so that people can relearn, people go back to university later in life. I was a semi-mature student. I was 22 when I went to university. As you described at the beginning of our discussion, I went to evening class, and when I got a job, I got day released to college to get the qualifications that got me to university. But I've been learning ever since. And I think if I could just say to your listeners who are grandparents, parents, or young people who have not yet gone back to school or college or university, if we could light that candle where whatever we do and whatever the capability and the aptitude of the young person, they start to love learning, the love of learning, and we don't. We turn youngsters off, particularly at secondary level. We've got to examine how we teach, what we teach, and why we're teaching it.
How do you foster a love of learning when you've got schools where resources are challenged, infrastructure is challenged, teachers are striking, there's been a pandemic, online learning remains prevalent in some areas? How do you do it?
Well, let's presume immediately that every teacher wants to set that candle alight, that they really want to be able to reach youngsters, whatever their aptitude. Because they're so different, the importance of pupil-centred learning, which got a bad name, it has to be back on the agenda. Now, you can do this with new technology. You can set up a programme for each child in the class, which works to their strengths and at their speed, and you can use that as part of the tutoring programme that the government have invested in. I give credit where credit's due. And you can link that to the world of home, because quite a big challenge for the love of learning and the exploration of possibilities and aspiration of the future is a differential between what parents have experienced and how confident they are to help their youngsters. So we need to reach out and help the parents as well as switching on the children. And yes, of course, the more resource you have in terms of teaching assistants and the teacher becoming a manager and organizer of that learning is critically important. But I still think that with the sensible use of intelligent, artificial intelligence and technology, it would be possible over a period of time to really rethink how we reach students. And that's true of adults as well, with modular and micro credits, so that you could build up those credits over time. You don't always have to go into full-time learning. You can do part-time, you can do evening class,
So flexibility, you're talking about a lot more flexibility in the system.
Absolutely.
What about, I mean, one of your recommendations is, and I know I'm being too literal with this, but humour me, public-private collaborations. And I wondered what you thought of Eton now describing itself as a charity and collaborating to set up these, with Star Academies to set up these schools. Do you think that there is value in, because that includes a lot of the things you're talking about in terms of access to tutoring and so on. Do you think that that is a good purpose that perhaps public schools could be put to in that way?
Well, I think there's a real possibility. I've spoken to William Waldegrave, who's the provost, and Simon Henderson, who's the head, about this. This is not a new idea. It goes back to the late 60s and Anthony Crossland. We, that was essentially myself and Estelle Morris and the team at Education, looked at how we could collaborate in terms of shortage subjects like Latin, where youngsters who felt the aptitude and needed Latin for their progress could link in to the private sector, who have much more capacity. We thought this in terms of specialist subjects like music, where someone has a very specific aptitude and you could develop it. My problem with what Eton are doing at the moment, and it wouldn't apply everywhere, but it applies in some areas, is that they come in as a cuckoo in the nest, where sixth form colleges and sixth forms have just started to really improve dramatically, and they pull out the better, the academically more able students.
Like,
and at that moment, they undermine those institutions that have really begun to transform themselves. So I think there are areas of the country where there is a crying need for excellence post 16, because this is what they're doing. But I think there's areas of the country where if they really collaborated, they could link, again using technology, between the school and Eton College, and they could really make this work for the benefit of everyone rather than just for a very small few.
There's a lot of conversation, just moving on to universities, a lot of conversation recently about, you know, why do we have universities there as the sort of totem or the aspiration, and that vocational skills are just as important and apprenticeships should be focused on more and so on. And also a sort of dismissal of liberal arts subjects as not equating to a good job or a particularly well-paid job at the end of that degree. I wondered what you thought about that, because, I mean, you've said that, you know, universities will only win over local populations if they, you know, avoid the elephant trap of being involved in identity politics and cancel culture. Do you think that universities need to sell themselves better in terms of their offer?
Well, I'm attending the Universities UK annual conference in Manchester later this week, and I shan't hector them, but I will say that we really do need to start presenting what universities are doing and could do a lot more effectively. Many of them are anchor institutions in their local community. They're transformational, not just in terms of the jobs, but the input into the local economy through knowledge transfer into the business community. So the collaboration between universities and businesses is really profound, but you wouldn't know about it unless you actually got involved and made an effort to find out. And that applies, obviously, in terms of research and development and our global role as well as the local one. And the two are not incompatible, and nor are vocational and academic coming together incompatible. The University of Sheffield and Warwick pioneered, and others are now doing it, the idea of advanced apprenticeships. So the university is linked to the apprenticeship program in the business, and they give the opportunity to get a degree through the apprenticeship. And then if they want to go on to postgraduate or whatever and into research, they can do so. I think it's a false dichotomy between those who are taking BTEC National Diploma and now T-levels on the one hand and those who are doing A-levels and academic routes on the other. I think we need to mix them. And I think we need to mix them at higher education and further education level so that there's a collaborative approach. It is happening. It's spreading it and scaling it up and getting the message across that simply abusing one of the gems in our crown, that is our higher education institutions, one of our massive contributions to global well-being, to trash that is a massive mistake.
And where do you think identity politics and cancel culture fit in with that? I mean, in what way are they being detrimental, should we say, to the advancement of universities?
Well, the irony is there's not a lot of it, but when there is, people are able to highlight it and pick on it, and you'll read it on a front page much more readily when somebody's done something silly, like, you know, shouldn't really be reading that book, or let's spend all our time, I've got to be careful how I pronounce this word, decolonializing the curriculum. Okay, there are things that could be done, sensible things that nobody would disagree with. And there are things that divert us and become a fetish. And once they do, then they allow others to exploit that and to be able to present the university sector as something that we can afford to criticise roundly and to rubbish rather than to be proud of and to improve. And it's a simple message, really, that you only have to read, not necessarily the Times, I have to say, but just take a look at some of the...
But it's an excellent paper.
Of course it is, Mariella. Take a look at some of the other newspapers occasionally, and you'll see these stories. And I don't want to give them legs.
Fair enough. Just finally, and I'm going to get into terrible trouble for crashing the news, but okay. We talk a lot about the negatives, and yet you are a prime example, a sterling example of a kid who started out with very little chance of furthering their education in any way. You developed an aptitude for learning, so much so that you ended up being education secretary. How do you explain what happened with you? What was it that gave you this hunger for knowledge and determination to succeed against the odds that you've described so accurately today?
You need to set the fire. You need to ensure that there's a desire to do better, to believe in yourself, to actually have that aspiration. And that means building tenacity and self-belief. And that can only happen if there are people around you who are prepared to help. One teacher came down in his own time, week after week, to evening class to help me get what was then O-level physics, which I'd have never got without him. So it's a commitment to each other, but it requires us to get up off our bums. I'm not going to say get on our bikes, but get up off our bums and be prepared to put a shift in. And if you get the two together, then for most, not for all, but for most, it will work.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.